All right, welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman. This is Russ Landy with me for Scout Talk, and we're just going to jump right into this. You know, one of the things that we've talked about, you know, pretty much throughout the past couple of weeks has been the Super Bowl, and you know, Russ, I've been waiting for years to see if an issue that I thought might be a problem with Jimmy Garoppolo would appear in a pivotal moment during a game, and really the issue has been how he handles pressure. You know, it was something that I saw at Eastern Illinois where it just seemed like he would kind of perceive pressure too early and react to it in a way where it was either in a way where he would take defensive action before he even finished throwing the ball. And sometimes it was done in a way that was effective and worked, but oftentimes I'd see it in a way where it affected his accuracy, or times where he would kind of turtle up and drop to the ground before pressure even arrived. Now, this was in more severe circumstances and didn't happen all the time, but it was enough for me to have a kind of a concern with him. And, you know, and I wondered if it would ever show up, but between him backing up Brady in New England and then working behind an excellent scheme in San Francisco, I've only seen the less severe angle of, you know, Garoppolo doing this. And he did help them reach a Super Bowl. So while I saw it was troublesome and kind of a flaw, it was only now that we're looking under this, you know, huge electron microscope of the biggest game of the year and the biggest game of his career. And you start to see maybe there, you know, there were some plays I watched, including one of the plays where he threw an inaccurate ball, and I show a close up of it, and the defender hasn't even hit him yet, and he's already wincing and closing his eyes before the defender even reaches him. And so, you know, again, with quarterbacks, you know, it's a tough position, and no, I don't want to sit there and call the guy a coward, because he's not a coward. He'll take contact. Exactly. He'll deal with a hit. But this is a small, you know, this is a minute thing that may be the difference between why Garoppolo wasn't able to make throws, whereas a guy like Patrick Mahomes is able to make throws and some other guys can. And it was an issue that I even had an NFL team exec ask me about before that draft, saying he saw my analysis on Garoppolo. The team that he was, you know, a part of loved him, and they loved him during the pre-draft process, but he wanted to present this information. And I remember thinking, well, the Patriots drafted him, and who they ended up drafting, I know didn't end up working out. It was kind of had an up and down career for them. And they'd certainly got some playoff work from him that was positive, but it wasn't someone who ended up being a long-term option for them. And I thought, wow, you know, it's interesting to hang on such a small detail that may never show up. So I guess, you know, that's a long windup, but I wanted to kind of bring that out to say, when you see a quarterback or a player who maybe has something that could cause, you know, have some issue that may be problematic, you know, but it's something that may only show up in a very, you know, select kind of circumstance, you know, do you discount it? Is it something that you look at and decide, you know, that you can work with it? Or do you have sometimes when it's something like maybe pressure like this, do you look at it and say, well, we want a quarterback who's going to be able to make the big game decisions and be able to like stand in there and handle the pressure, especially in a bigger game where even if you have great surrounding talent, it's less likely that surrounding talent's going to be able to hide that flaw. And I think that's what happened in this game. But, you know, how would you approach something like this?
Well, firstly, I think there are two, to me, I always view it as two different things when you sort of have that flaw. Is it a physical flaw that you feel you can work on and physically change a habit? Or is it a mental flaw? And in quarterback, a lot of time it's a mental flaw. And in this case, this is a mental flaw. It's either perceiving pressure or, if there is pressure, panicking and rushing and starting to get frenetic and too fast. Obviously, it's a huge concern for a quarterback. And yes, can you sometimes mitigate it like they've done, which is a strong line and their scheme? I mean, he's rarely sitting back there facing a full rush snap after snap. They do so much motion. They move him out of the pocket. They do a lot of stretch running. So all those things take away from him having to be a sitting duck. But I think when you look at the mental side of a quarterback, that to me is something that rarely changes. You may be able to improve it. But I look back, and one of the guys I missed on coming out was Blaine Gabbert.
Oh,
and I remember I had notes on him saying, I'm a little nervous about him when there's pressure, but there were only a few notes, and the rest of his film was so good, I sort of overlooked that. But then when he got in the NFL, you saw that. Then you had Derek Carr. The first one that was drafted by Houston. Those were some of the things you saw at Fresno. And the same with his brother when he came out. Not to as great an extent, but the same sort of thing. To me, guys that tend to perceive the pressure rarely end up being the great quarterbacks you want them to be, because the best players in the best games are going against the most talent. And that means there's going to be pressure. I know I always like to remember back to when I first was learning about quarterbacks. I was fortunate to spend a year going to watch film with Jaws every week at NFL Films. And Jaws has, like everybody, their own things they love and hate about quarterbacks. But one of his big things that he always said is, will he stare down the barrel of a gun and just get destroyed to make a throw? And he would always point to guys like Philip Rivers, because Philip can't move anyway. So for him, it's either stand strong or just duck and take the sack. And he loved that Philip would just stand there and literally get obliterated. But the ball would come out. And you don't see that with a lot of quarterbacks. Obviously, Tom Brady's one that has shown a long history of doing that. And it's not always bad. There are guys like Russell Wilson who they're so naturally – they have a feel for true pressure. They can anticipate it and get out of the pocket. But there's a difference between anticipating it and getting out to avoid it than staying in and allowing that pressure to affect what you do throwing the ball. And I think with Garoppolo, it's a concern. I have that concern anytime I see a quarterback do that, that's something I'm not going to be able to fix. Now, does that mean I automatically eliminate him? No. Because with Garoppolo, when I remember grading him, I gave him a second-round grade when he came out. I said, you know, there's so many positives that are there with him that, yes, this is a negative, but at some point there's value in, hey, maybe that's going to be a negative, but he has so many other traits that point to his being a starter that I'm willing to give him a second or third-round grade.
Yeah, and I think that makes total sense, because it's one of those deals where, you know, when I look at a player like that, I used to do kind of disqualifiers, and for a while I toyed with the idea of doing a disqualifier for that particular issue, especially after what happened with Blaine Gabbert. I thought I don't want to pick a quarterback like that and not see that coming. And so I wanted to have a disqualifier. And I thought, how would I handle that? Would I just say that disqualifies him from being within a certain range of, you know, players on my board? Would I say that that's a backup caliber thing that, you know, he automatically isn't someone I project as a starter, or is that too harsh? And ultimately I decided not to use the disqualifier, because I felt like for this exact reason with Garoppolo, or players with that particular issue, if you the fact that you can get to a Super Bowl with a player like this, you know, with all the skills that he does have, why are you going to throw that away from that standpoint? Because very rarely you're going to find perfect players. You know, it was in this case, sadly, one of the differences in this game was that Garoppolo wasn't able to preemptively adjust to that pressure in a healthy way and a productive way, whereas Mahomes may not have stood in there and took the shot all the time, though he did take some shots, but he was able to, even when the throws weren't pinpoint accurate, he was able to anticipate. And not only did Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy able to move the pocket for him a little bit more, but he also started to move out of the way, realizing that his linemen were mismatched and, you know, and it was time for him to move out a little earlier so that he could control the narrative of how he wanted to move and throw off platform. And oftentimes he just threw the ball to open zones and let his receivers work to it and got there a little early, and the ball may not have been pinpoint, but it was there. And to me, that was the measure of a quarterback who put his players in position to win and put himself in a position to win, and a quarterback who basically reacted to the fact that his teammates couldn't keep him in a position where he could win. And I think that it's such a small thing.
I almost feel that it's sort of proactive and reactive, right?
Yes.
I mean, Mahomes is being proactive because he has that awareness and that instinct and that poise. Whereas Garoppolo is almost reactive because by the time he reacts, it's in his face. He doesn't know what to do. So I see what your point. It's perfect. It makes perfect sense. Yeah.
But it also kind of delves into where I think sometimes, especially media, when they talk about scouting players, what they miss between the line between, you know, scouting players and then how you manage whether you're going to have them on your staff long term.
Yep,
you know, 100%. It's one thing, because a lot of people will say that, well, why would you even pick him then? Because you don't want to have to give him a big, expensive second contract, you know, with that kind of an issue if that starts showing up and now you've heavily invested in him. Well, that, you know, I hate to say it this way, but if you're scouting in some respects, that's not your problem. I mean, yes, you want to be thinking about that if that's what your team wants you to be thinking about to an extent. But if they're like, this guy can help us win right now, Let the management worry about how they're going to approach his work with the team and the deal that they make with the team long term. And it's up to them to understand the positives and negatives with that player and how they've developed or haven't developed. And then they need to have the wisdom to act on that. And all we do is provide the information.
Well, that's where I would almost say it goes back to sort of the character thing, which is, as I've been told over and over when I started, by the higher ups, is that's above your pay grade. Your job as a scout is identify the issue. Certain coaches may feel, hey, I know I have drills I do, I have things I can do that will mitigate this and change. Other ones may say, I'm out on that. That's not something I'm willing to deal with. I think that's an unfixable trait. And it's actually come up in discussions when I was at the Rams, and given I was a nobody, but one of the things that we had at the Rams, and you've probably seen it in my book, is I have an alphabetical grading scale that goes with the numerical. Each letter goes to a certain trait. And mine is a little condensed because I don't want to be mean to players. So for me, I put an M for a player that either has a mental for instincts, awareness, or an L for learning. They're both combined to be an M. So I don't want to publicly say a kid can't learn. I don't think that's appropriate.
Right.
But when we were at the Rams, there was the debate with quarterbacks, both with pressure and the ability to read the defense. Do we put an M on a guy who every other trait is a first-round trait? Because if we put an M on a player, at least in the system we had at the Rams and the one I've continued to use, that limits him to being selected no higher than the fourth round.
Yeah.
So, and that's at any position, but do you want to risk that with a quarterback? It was one of the big debates we had, because that's such a hard position to find. But I will say, I believe for a quarterback, the mental is so vital that if you as an organization are confident, everybody that's watched the film, they all say, doesn't handle pressure in the pocket well, not instinctive with it. To me, that is an M. And that's a guy that, like I said, I like Garoppolo, and I think he's become a solid quarterback. But I can definitely understand the team saying, we're going to put an M on him, and we're going to put him in the second grouping of quarterbacks because we don't think that can be fixed.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of where I think that's where I fall ultimately. But it makes so much sense what you're talking about, is that, you know, that wouldn't be the pay grade of someone who's just evaluating the talent there. So in a lot of teams, and it is something that if they believe they can work with that and they have the confidence with it, and they're essentially saying, I understand, thank you for sharing the information, if they're not even going to say that, but you've done your job. Okay.
Yep. Then all you can do is present them with, this kid's got a learning problem, or this kid's not poised, or this kid's a criminal or has a drug problem or whatever it may be. At some point, it becomes the ball's in their court. They're the ones getting the big bucks. It's their jobs on the line. If they feel that they can turn a kid that you, along with other scouts, mentally doesn't have the chops to play quarterback, but he feels confident after interviewing him, he can. Hey, that's why he's the head coach of GM, and that decision's been given to him by the higher-ups. And your job at that point is to say, I hope I'm wrong.
Exactly. So, you know, one of our listeners is David Whitman, who's who also is enrolled in Dan Hatman's Scouting Academy, and he's an aspiring analyst. And he asked me a few weeks ago before the holidays and before the Senior Bowl, he was like, how do you guys organize your work when studying players? He wanted to know specifically the ways that maybe we budget our time for specific aspects of studying players, and is it, you know, when it comes to scheduling, do we do a little bit each day? Do we do larger chunks of viewing time on specific days of the week? And he just wants to know what we found to work best when it comes to how we organize and schedule the work we do to study players.
Well, I think you can probably speak to this just like I can, is there is a huge difference in scheduling time when you have access to game film for a player as opposed to when you're having to use TV film for a player. Because when I have access to game film, which I do now that I'm with Calgary, I actually got my stuff yesterday that has every college game in the country the last 2 years on two different like 20 terabyte drives. So I will be watching game film for the foreseeable future. But when you have that, I find the rule, and what I was taught in the NFL, and it generally held true, is if you're looking at a team, and most scouts will grade team by team as opposed to individual players. When you're grading team by team, if a team has six or more players, the rule of thumb is that's a two-day evaluation. And that's basing it on, you can generally watch film from about 8 to 2 o'clock when you're at a school. So you can get about 5 to 6 hours in. So if you have six or more players, it's going to take you more than 5 or 6 hours. And that's sort of how I break it down. I generally will do one side of the ball first, try to get 3 or 4 games done, and then flip over and do the other side. I'm a big believer in making sure you don't turn on the film until you have every player identified with jersey number, position, where he's playing, who's hurt, who's not hurt, everything, so that there's little wasted time once you actually start watching film. And this will sound strange, but the first quarter of the first game, I don't ever take notes. I just want to get used to the flow of where a guy lines up, what he does. And for me, I find that helps me be faster and get to the getting 4 to 5 guys per, like, for a school done each day.
I think that's great. And I think that where we differ is really talks about our level of experience in different realms, because your experience with dealing with getting, you know, coaches tape, the experience having a budget of players that you have to cover for deadlines that are shorter deadlines than what I have. I mean, my deadline basically runs from April 2nd through, you know, March 31st, you know, of the next year. So however I want to do that, I can go about doing that. You know, if I want to watch, you know, Henry Ruggs, you know, on April 3rd of 2018 or 2019 and not watch him again until tomorrow, you know, and still be in time for what I want to do, that's fine. I can do that. But you know, I think it's important that what you're doing is where most people who are in this are looking for that as the model. Like, what is the football scout's model for doing this, and the realism of how that works. Now, what I might be able to add that might be different is, how do you get to the point where you're scouting players where you can watch 6 hours of tape and watch six different players doing that and get quick enough to do that? And I would say where I would start is start from a much more basic level. And how I kind of organize my day is part of it is that when I first, if you're just starting out and what you want to do is build your way to the point that you can do what Russ is doing, I would recommend picking one player and watch as many games as possible and spend a month on like one position. Just, you know, spend a month, 2 months if you want, whatever. I would spend as much time as you can possibly stomach on one position and really study the ins and outs of that player and take your time. And if it means that you're going to watch the same play dozens of times, and then you start thinking, that reminds me of Maurice Jones-Drew, and you have the opportunity to go to YouTube and watch some and like skim through Maurice Jones-Drew highlights until you find something that looks like what that player you were watching in college is doing, go do that. You have the time to do that, go do it, because you'll get a lot more out of your experience, not just finishing the report, because who are you finishing the report for anyway?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, take the time to go, why is it that I'm reminded of Maurice Jones-Drew? And was I right to be reminded of that? Or what does he do that's different than this guy? So that helps me understand, you know, what it is that I thought I was seeing compared to what I'm actually seeing, and do those things. So if it takes you 2 weeks to do one scouting report on a player, if you've really approached it honestly to like answer all the questions that you've had with it and take notes on it, then take that time and do it, because 100%. Man, the next time you start doing this stuff, then you can like, you know, after if you spend a year or two doing that, I guarantee you, if you have an eye for what you need to be looking for and know how to integrate things together, you've seen enough, you've systematically studied it enough that you can look at a player. For me, running back's my position where I feel like I can probably watch one. I don't do this, but I feel like I can watch one game and have a pretty good beat on a guy. Like, yep. And honestly, sometimes I feel like I can watch like three plays and tell you, this guy's worth studying some more, this guy's not worth studying anymore. Now I still go through it because I feel like it's important to make sure I haven't missed anything, but that's what happens when you build on those layers. So to me, if you're starting out, I recommend that you have a very systematic way of how you're looking at things, down to the point of how do you define what you're looking at? What is it? What's the standard that you're using? And look at it before you start, you know, read it out loud and look at it and then go, is this what I'm looking for? And then, you know, or have a list of things that you're looking for. So you don't have to look at a 50-point list of things, but maybe just to start with, pick like five things that you want to notice about that player, whether it's his footwork, his pad level, his ball security, and, you know, his burst. You know, and define what each of those things are to you, and then start watching players with that, and yep. then expand it outward until you feel like you've got a good working definition of those things, and then keep going with it. Because I think you'll be better off if you are really good at seeing like a limited number of things, as opposed to like being half-assed at seeing dozens of things.
Yep. You know? And you know what? That's one of the reasons, because I teach a class also on this. One of the things I always tell them, because a lot of them want to know, how do I take notes? Because they send me a report and it's completely, so much of the stuff is missing. They leave lines blank and everything. I say, well, the simplest way to learn what you should be scouting for is to print out a blank report and write your notes on the blank report. Because I said, you will notice areas you're not taking notes. Those areas you need to start watching and paying more attention to. And over time, if you were to take a player and say you're obviously like most people, unlike you and I who can do this and this, this is our job, you're doing it around a schedule. Well, if you watch one game a week over the span of 5 or 6 weeks of the same player, over each week you're going to notice you're going to start to fill out more and more of the notes on the report. And after 6 or 7 games of watching one player, you'll realize, wow, I really have complete notes. Like then you could sit down and actually write the report without a lot of questions and debate about, oh, I didn't really get much on his receiving skills. Well, if you didn't fill it out when you were taking notes, you didn't take enough notes and watch enough film. So you got to keep watching. And that's one of the things I try to impart to them is the blank report is a great way for the first 10 or 15 players at each position to really learn what you have to take notes on so that eventually you don't have to have that template there. You just know in your head, when you're watching a running back, here are all the things I have to look at before I can say, yep, I've seen enough. I'm ready to move on.
Yeah, because it's an ingrained process. I mean, I have my checklists up of everything that I do, but the definitions of what those are, that's just from ingrained of writing them down several times and updating them and referring to them for years. Now I don't do that unless I get to a point where I feel like I'm stuck between, you know, how I would define two different tiers of a performance. And I have to go back and double check what it is I said, and does one of them fit more, that better? And if it doesn't, how do I need to change what I'm doing? And then that becomes a learning process. But it's like, yeah, I would recommend, like what you said, it makes so much sense having that blank sheet and being able to do that. And I would just go one more step and say, fill it out to the point of ridiculous. Like 100%. Not that you would, yes. Not to the point of like, maybe a GM's going to look at you and go, that's way too much information, but you're not doing it for a GM. You're doing it for you. Yep. And like, if you can fill it out. Like if you're playing with your little boy or little girl playing a game of like I Spy, or to like point out every possible detail that you can see, like the smallest detail in a room, then you want to do the same thing here. So if you're looking at a receiver run a wide, you know, a running back run a wide route, and you want to talk about when he turns his head, how many steps he took outside, did he change the length of the steps? Did he, you know, did he do anything with any part of his body that would show that he was, you know, when did he start to turn? Where are his hands positioned? Where does the ball contact his hands? Is it on the fingers? Is it on the, you know, I mean, to that granular yep. detail, because what ends up happening, you're being a writer. And the thing that's between writing for, you know, scouting reports, or whether you're writing a feature for media, when you write like long form features, I did a lot of long form writing for a career for a while, is that I found that when you had tons and tons and tons of notes, the problem with it is that you then have to sort through all of it and figure out what's going to make the best story. But you never have to worry about whether you have enough material. It's yes. just about figuring out how to filter it down. So if you start out, instead of starting out with here's 50 things I'm looking for, and then you're going to be granular with everything, start with 5 things and yep. be so granular that it looks like you looked at 50 things. And then you'll start to gradually learn what you can, what's not as important. Like, do I really need to notate the coverage of the safeties, you know, on the opposite side of the field of where the running back's running to on a route? No.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But the fact that you're thinking about that might also help you see, well, the coverage now rotated before the snap, and that's why the safety who was high on the running back side was able to get up so close and be able to, you know, disrupt the running back after the catch, because you know you've already been training yourself to take a look at these things. So yeah, the more granular you are early on, the better off you are. So when you talk about a schedule, don't think about how much you get done. Think about what you're going to focus on and getting as much that you can see over a period of time as possible, whether it's 1 day, 3 days, a month. And if you finish a scouting report on one player over the span of 2 weeks, but you have enough information that it looks like you could write like a chapter of a book on him, you're on the right track early on.
Oh, there's no, and the thing I'll add in, because I love the way you put it, is a lot of the kids who take my class, they submit their first report or two, and they're disappointed when I send them back literally a page and a half of notes of here's the issues.
Yeah.
What I try to tell everybody is, hey, and this was told to me early on, and not told to me, physically shown to me, but the first 50 to 100 reports you write, you basically could print them, pick them up off the printer, crumple them into a thing, and shoot them into the trash, because they're bad. Yeah. It takes a long time to become good. When I was at the Rams and I had just moved into my second year there and I'd been watching a lot of film and typing reports, my new boss looked at my reports. He said, I appreciate all the hard work. He crumpled them up one by one and threw them out. And he said, I don't want to see them. He said, in 6 months when you've written another 400, then I want to start seeing them. He said, right now your reports stink and they don't help. And it wasn't that he didn't say it in a way that was most helpful. But the reality is, the writing of it, the condensing, like you said, when you have tons of information, condensing it to a report that paints a picture, but also gets into granular detail on the important things that that position needs to be important about, it doesn't happen overnight. No matter how educated you are, no matter what a great English major and writer you were in college, it takes time to develop that. And yes. That's why I wouldn't overly get nervous as you're writing the first 10 or 50 or 100 reports that they're not great. Just write. Just yeah. take your notes, be thorough, and write a report. The more you do it, the better you become.
Yeah. I mean, mine were awful. I remember when I look back on some of mine from like 10, you know, 15 years ago, I look at them and go, wow, like this is what I thought I was supposed to be doing. Like it's, and it makes me laugh. But I know now that even if I went to an NFL team, because I don't even have the experience of doing it in that setting, that someone would probably look at my stuff and go and give me a slew of notes of like, here's how we approach it. Here's how we need you to do it. Here's what you're not looking at. Here's what you're looking at too deeply, in our opinion. Here, you know, or here's how you would schedule. It would be a different that it would be an adjustment, because it's, wherever you go to work, there's always going to be an adjustment, especially if it's a different setting, you know? So
100%.
So you have to be aware of that. So, I mean, yeah, that's, I think that's a topic that I, you know, hopefully David, that's helpful to you, you know, and getting a chance to see the reality of what it's like actually out in the, you know, the NFL, CFL world, in terms of the football world. And then in terms of if you're an analyst who's possibly going to be doing this, you know, for a media outlet, and also for yourself learning to get started. So, you know, let's talk about a specific player, and a player that I just posted on my site was kind of an unsung favorite for me, is a senior, as a Shrine Game running back out of South Carolina by the name of Rico Dowdle. He's out of Asheville, North Carolina. And he's a player who shined at the Shrine Game week, from what I heard. And from what I've seen on film, he's really flashed some high end skills. You know, I think he has starter ability as a runner and a receiver from the backfield. When you watch even his freshman tape, there's flashes of that ability to kind of peekaboo around one gap and then head to another, in the way that you'd see with Mixon and Le'Veon Bell. And he has the burst to do it. He catches the ball extremely well downfield, contested plays, is able to adjust his body and track the ball over his head in tight areas. He has that ability also to set up defenders, you know, one level above of where he's heading. So he can, you know, press and cut back, really scrape that, you know, his blocker that he's, you know, working around, and then be able to set up the spin move on the linebacker or safety, you know, and see that coming ahead of time. So, and there's a lot that I love about him, but he spent a lot of time in the training room. You know, he had a sports hernia during his career. He had a broken ankle. He's had knee injuries. None of them really were lasting severity, but cost him significant portions of games. And the staff ended up, you know, basically they ended up getting Tavion Feaster, who was a 4-star recruit who ended up going to Clemson, but kind of got pushed out by Travis Etienne. And so Dowdle competed with Feaster for playing time and clearly beat out Feaster early and played well before he suffered another injury that cost him some time. So, you know, what was interesting about his story and his skills is that before even anyone mentioned the NFL draft and Rico Dowdle at the same time, back in May of this year, when they brought Tavion Feaster in through the, you know, and he transferred, they were asked by an athletic correspondent who covers the South Carolina about, I guess, the running back depth chart. And the staff said that if Rico Dowdle truly put in the work, he could be a much better player. And I want to say a much better player than he already is, something to the extent that implied he could be a top tier type of player. So what I wanted to know is, when you hear a staff make that kind of statement, and it isn't from a scout asking it before the draft or visiting upon a visit to evaluate tape, but they say that out loud just to the media in general, and it's kind of, you know, put out there just when the media is asking about, what's your running back depth chart look like? You know, what are the kind of questions you ask when you look at a situation like Dowdle, if you were to take my word for it, that's how he plays and the challenges that he's dealt with, you know, what kind of thoughts would you have, and how would you want to explore it further?
Well, there are two things. When I hear a coach say that publicly, it tells me one of two things. Either the staff just doesn't like the kid for whatever reason. The kid either isn't tough, hasn't worked hard, whatever, and they just don't care anymore, so they're just coming out right and say it. Or they're genuinely using this as a hook to motivate.
Right.
And I think it's a very risky thing, for a coach to say, but I think it's even more risky when you allow that statement to affect what you would say about the player as a scout or as a media person, because what a coach says publicly is often very different than what either he or people within the building will say. My rule of thumb was, in most buildings, there's going to be someone who doesn't like every player. Even the best player, there's going to be someone who doesn't like him, whether he didn't recruit him or the kid he recruited, that guy beat out for a job. And there's so many different things. So with something like this, if I had a kid that, and I'm going to put it in the context of, say this kid was a junior. So I hadn't asked about him when I went to the school, but I hear the coach say this and really basically say the kid's not tough publicly. That to me would cause me to call everybody at the school, because my rule has always been, if I get 5 or 6 or 8 people in the same building, coaches, trainers, equipment guys, video guys, academic advisors, secretaries, if I talk to 8 or 10 or 12, whatever the number may be, and there's a variance of opinions about it, then it means there's something going on and you really got to dig deep. But if every single person says the same thing but says it with different language, that tells you there's probably a big red flag, whether he's not really tough, whether he's injury prone, whatever it may be. But I will say the one area, and this is why I specifically said with different words, there are times where you will talk to 10, 12, even 15 people in a building, and everybody will literally say exactly what that coach said, almost verbatim. And when you hear that, you have to know, okay, the word's been sent down from above.
Yes.
This is what we're saying. So that's where you really have to do some digging. And you have to find out, what is this kid's deal? And it's important because there are a few reasons. One is, and especially now with analytics, it's even showing people that had doubted the statement before are seeing it more now, which is, statistically, if you're hurt in college, the odds are you will most likely be hurt in the pros. Every analytics regression analysis shows, I think it's over 12 or 14 games, somewhere right around there, missed in college, points to having major issues in the NFL, staying durable and starting full seasons. So that's one thing that you have to be concerned with. If a kid has been dinged up, whether it's legitimate big injuries or minor injuries, is it's going to be a problem. The other concern is if it's minor stuff, not something that needs surgery during the year but can be fixed after the season or just needs rest after the season, those are the ones that get you very concerned. Because, and you know this, Matt, you've been covering this for 20 years now, is once training camp starts in the NFL, within a week, everybody's hurt. No one's walking around like, even the first-round pick who's 22, even he's got swelling in the knee or an elbow that's bothering him within 3 practices, because this is an extraordinarily violent game. So you have to find out, is this a player who will be able to deal with those things on a regular basis? And when you talk to the staff, if you do get the impression that this is an inherently tough kid, he just had some bad breaks, that's one thing. But one of the things that trainers have been taught to say as a way to protect themselves from lawsuits, but also to make it known that this kid's going to be an issue, is they will say, when this kid's 100%, he will give 100% and be a great player for you, which is basically saying he's never going to be healthy and you want to stay away from him. And it's a very hard thing because, like we talk about, at every point in the draft, there's a value. When you have an elite talent like a Terrell Davis, nobody at the school thought he'd be able to stay healthy. They inherently thought that he was just a fragile kid, not mentally, just his body couldn't take the pounding. So he wasn't going to go early. But his tape, when he was healthy, was freak-like. So at some point, there becomes a value where you say, you know what, we don't think this guy's ever going to last. We're pretty sure he's going to break in the first year in the NFL and be done. But he's so gifted that we're willing to waste a 5th or a 6th or a 7th, because in those rounds, generally, you're getting guys that most likely can't make your team long-term and help them. And often are missing 2 or 3 of the 4 or 5 critical factors to be successful backups. Well, at that point, sometimes it's worth throwing in a dart that if you took out the injury part, every box is checked. Yeah, why wouldn't you take a shot on a guy that may have already have arthritis in his knee or have a shoulder or whatever it may be? The biggest thing I always try to tell people is every kid, and especially with this, with it being his injuries or character, whatever it is, if someone makes a statement publicly, it shouldn't affect what you think. It should just make sure you know you better check all your work in terms of your research and the people you talk to make sure you know everything about this kid from the proper sources to be able to put the appropriate thing together in terms of package or bow or report, however you want to term it, to get that point across to your bosses, to the public if you're doing it in the media, because you don't ever want to take what a coach says and just say we're running with that. Because coaches have motives. Coaches, they may be talking about him, but in reality, they're telling two other players on the team that know that they're just like him and they're always in the training room together, and those guys are sophomores. And this coach is pointing this kid out because he's leaving. He doesn't care anymore. But he wants those two sophomores who have been sitting around with him to know that if they don't change, he's going to say the same thing about them.
Yeah, and that's such great information. And I'm glad you touched upon Terrell Davis, because I was at the school covering that team during that time, you know, just as a student. And it was interesting because what we come to find out later, too, was he didn't want to let anybody show tape to scouts of Terrell Davis. That Goff didn't want that to even be a part of the protocol, which was unheard of, which is a red flag on the coach in a sense.
100%.
Because, you know, so because the player, of course, is going to claim, well, I won't say a course, but I think it would be, you know, if you're going to look at it cynically, that the player is likely going to say, well, I am really hurt. They don't think I am. Like, yes. I know the difference between playing with pain and playing hurt. And that's what was, that was Terrell Davis's contention. Whereas, you know, Goff's contention was he's how you described, you know, what some players, you know, are seen as. But on top of that, it was kind of like he also kind of put up a gate in a way that wasn't as polished as the way that you characterize it for other teams, which is everyone says the same party line. It's come down to this is the PR party line that we're going to give. Whereas a lot of this was, you know, we can't talk about him. We're not allowed to talk about him with you, you know? And so if you hear that, and I don't think you'll hear that in this day and age, but if you heard that, plus they're not even going to allow you to see the tape, that tells you that there's a personal issue with the coach and the player, you know?
No question. And it goes both ways, Mike, because the perfect example is when people look back at Mike Price, the old head coach up at Washington State. They put out word within the staff that they weren't to say negative things about Ryan Leaf. So people would go there and they talk to people. And I wasn't on the road scouting then. I was in the office with the Rams. But our scouts didn't come back with unbelievable negatives.
Yeah,
they came back with there's a question of overconfidence. There's a question is, so sometimes it works both ways. They try to protect their kid. And I'm not trying to rip Ryan. I mean, I think what he's done in terms of turning things around, it's unbelievable. But it's just an example that sometimes schools will go the other way and they'll so protect the kid that I look back and think, you know, if they had told teams up front, he still may have gone in the top five, but maybe the team that took him would have been more prepared and known how to provide the resources so that Ryan could have succeeded. Because what would have happened if Ryan came out, maybe sat for 2 years and got the mentorship that he needed and maybe was taught about being a professional. Maybe it would have been a whole other story. And with Terrell Davis, what if when he had come out, teams understood that there had been an issue at Georgia, that some of it was the coach, some of it was probably him. There's never only one side. There's usually both sides. And if teams had known, hey, we think this kid's more talented. We like a lot of things about him. There's something missing here. We're going to spend more time with Terrell. Maybe he would have gone higher in the draft.
Right. Same with Arian Foster, who was 100%. The philosophy major that the staff apparently felt like he wasn't tough enough because he had interests outside of football.
Yep, and that's a big one. I mean, I don't know how many times I can tell you I've heard coaches say, I want smart kids, but I don't want kids that are too smart. Because I don't want kids asking me questions all day. It's like I'm pretty sure most of the best people in most professions want their people under them asking questions.
Right.
I mean, it's like I don't know who it is that always says it, whether it was Steve Jobs or whoever, but he always says, I want to hire people smarter than me. I mean, I'm not saying your linemen or your players have to be smarter, but at least want them to be thinking. and ask questions. So, I mean, yeah, it's a real tricky question. Where do you go? What information are you getting? Who do you go to verify it? How deep do you have to dig? There's so many things that play into it. I just think the biggest thing I always get from it is never take a coach who's speaking publicly about a player. Never take that word to be the gospel truth, because there's always a motivation. Every coach, they're not talking just about that player. There is a reason they're coming out and talking. Like when Jim Mora came out and defended Josh Rosen, when everybody started ripping Rosen. Well, if Jim Mora doesn't come out and defend his starting quarterback, whether he loves him or hates him, and I've heard it's more towards the second there, if he doesn't come out and defend him publicly, what is the next quarterback going to think? What's the next premier recruit that's sort of an arrogant kid going to think? Do I want to go to UCLA where my coach can throw me under the bus if I'm a little bit arrogant? Or is he thinking, man, this guy goes to bat for me no matter what I do? That's the coach I want.
Yeah, that's a great point. And certainly I think that that's, you know, and I was going to ask you about Rosen, actually, because it's fascinating, because he is that player that, you know, has had that reputation of wanting to ask a lot of questions, you know, and certainly I've talked to my share of quarterback consultants, guys who work with, you know, some CFL players, who work with, you know, guys like Rich Bartel and Will Hewlett. Will Hewlett works with a QB collective. That's a big thing with, like, here in Atlanta now with, you know, Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan. And he works with a lot of, you know, he's very well known for working with a lot of players, you know, at the high school, college. Drew Bledsoe's son works with him, and yeah. So he's, you know, they do some awesome work on quarterback play, and they're the type of guys too that aren't that kind of, you know, they're the first to tell you, listen, you know, we're like private lesson teachers, but ultimately, you know, we didn't turn the guy into a great talent. We just helped a great talent get better, you know? So they're not the type that's going to tell you, we have the magic formula that's going to make your kid great, that, you know, that you'll see around everywhere. They have a pretty realistic, grounded view of things. But to a man, you know, Will played at Stanford, and he was a starter at Stanford. And I think he was the first non-North American to ever start. He's from New Zealand, I think.
Oh, wow.
So, or is either Australia or New Zealand. I think it's Australia, actually. And he's, you know, to ever start as a Division I quarterback. And, you know, Rich, I mean, he was a Tarleton and played in the CFL and played with the Cardinals. But both of them would talk about, you know, in an NFL, you know, being in an NFL locker room, and especially when it came to coaches, because there's such a diverse landscape of schemes, and they're so specialized, and there's so much layers and language that are different from one another. He said, what happens is there is a level of kind of insecurity among coaches that are like, this is my system. And everybody beneath that doesn't want to be embarrassed of not knowing every in and out of it. So there's a lot of faking it going on at times on this microcosmic level of, you know, learning scheme and doing things. So I can understand how, if that's going on, that there are some coaches that may be out there that maybe, I don't want too many questions. I just want people who do what I say, because then it turns into a football lesson where there are, you know, maybe there are fewer guys than we know who are equipped to look at it from as broad of a view, you know, as a Bill Belichick, who might be able to give you an encyclopedic knowledge about the game, or the other guys out there who certainly are skilled in that realm. But when it comes to newer coaches or younger guys, you know, maybe there's a point where, you know, it's just like any other, you know, work environment, where sometimes someone makes their name in a certain level, certain skill set or specific area. And then when they're asked to, you know, beyond their realm of knowledge, instead of being secure about it, that you get kind of these types of behaviors.
100%. Yep.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree more.
Well, listen, you know, we're 100% happy to be able to be doing this show. For those of you who are out here listening to Scout Talk, you can certainly subscribe to it on iTunes, Google Play, as well as Blueberry, Podbean, Spotify. You pretty much name it, it's out there. You can subscribe to your favorite delivery platform at Matt Waldman's RSP Film Room. For Russ Landy, who you can follow at Russ Landy on Twitter. You can find me at Matt Waldman on Twitter. We appreciate you listening to this. And if you have any questions that you would like to ask, that when it comes to the scouting or evaluation process about players, and you'd like to hear us talk about it, you can contact me at mattwaldmanrsp@gmail.com. And thanks again for listening, guys, and we will see you soon.